Well, good morning. My name is Solomon Kim. It is a pleasure to be here. I have been here before. I come here every first Sunday of October with a group of college students. I work for a college ministry that you are aware of called RUF. I work on the campus of MIT, which is in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. When Ian first asked, he gave me a few dates. We actually are not in school until February. We have like a January term where a lot of students do research and other projects and get some side jobs. And so I told him I'll be free that first month. And, when a lot of pastors, so I typically preach to a room of 18 to 22-year-olds. And so it's always a joy to preach to my own children. kidding aside, when I get asked by pastors to come fill in, I'm always grateful to do so. A lot of times, pastors just need the break. But, I know that in our interactions, Ian told me he really wanted to help out a church upstate, and I think it's just great to be able to come, not only to give a fellow peer and brother rest, but to give him an opportunity to do God's work up there. So I'm grateful for him. I'm grateful for this church. Let's begin. Let's look at this story. Jonah, you might be familiar with it. Maybe you have never read this story. Maybe it's been a long time. So let me just recap what's happened, because I read the last chapter. So the first three chapters, really the story would be great if it was a three-chapter story. Jonah is a prophet of God, and God tells him, I want you to give my word to that wicked city of Nineveh. And he says, I ain't going there. And he goes the opposite way to Tarshish. And bad things happen. Storm comes. They're on a sailboat where it's discovered that he's the reason for the storm. And so he is thrown overboard to his death, only to find a big fish swallow him up alive, where he would remain in the belly of the fish for 3 days. And in that belly, he cries out, he prays to God. So Jonah actually prays, and God delivers him. The fish spits him out with all its vomit, and he ends up on dry land. And he does, in chapter 3, here's the redemption of the story, is that Jonah actually does go to Nineveh, and he preaches to them, albeit a very short sermon. And the whole city of Nineveh, from all its people to its king, repents, and they believe the Lord. And it should stop right there, but it doesn't. We have this chapter where Jonah throws a pity party, and we have What I think, we have a lot to learn from this final chapter. This is not ideal. And in many ways, the characters in Scripture are not heroes. If they are heroes, if you want to call it that, they're heroes with feet of clay. Jonah is no hero. He is a guy who does a lot of grumbling and complaining. And I want us to consider three things as we look at this chapter. First, I want us to consider our mission. By mission, I simply mean our participation in God's mission of making his name known among the nations. Our participation in the work of God and towards the nations worshiping Jesus as God's son. Jonah hates mission. He hates the fact that God called him to go to Nineveh. The people to whom God sent him is the very people he hates These are people that he fears. The Ninevites are notorious. I actually have a friend who is doing probably a 7-year PhD program on ancient Assyria. And Nineveh is the capital of Assyria back then. They were ruthless people. In fact, they actually conquered God's people some decades, centuries after this episode. And God calls Jonah to send his good word, and he hates that job. He hates that job. And mission is often God's people going to places that they fear, going to people who hate their God. It's doing something that will fail without God's help. It's the church going to people, places, institutions, cities where Christ is not worshiped. Jonah wants none of that. And if we are honest with ourselves, we realize it's much easier to withdraw our Christian faith in the secular world than it is to bring our faith into the world. While I do work with college students, occasionally I would grab lunch with some folks in the area where I work that are working, and you know, they're all believers. We're actually in this book club. We go through a book, talk about it every week. You know, the single most difficult thing for Christian workers in Cambridge, they would tell me, is integrity. It's integrity. It's like they struggle with their identity as a Christian and working in a place where they literally will never talk about their faith. I'm actually not saying that their task is to share their faith in any particular way, but the struggle is very real. A friend of mine just retired after 40 years of teaching, and at the end of her retirement party, essentially, they asked her, you know, you've been so consistent in the way that you loved your student. You know, what was it that really got you going all those 40 years? And she says, 40 years later, she said, well, I'm a Christian, and I believe that God created all children equally with dignity, and I really see their dignity with God's design. And I think the room was actually shocked because they didn't know she was a Christian for 40 years. And one person said, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. It's very difficult to be a Christian in this world. The world used to think of Christians as naive, maybe intellectually naive for believing certain things that the Bible says, including the fact that a fish could swallow up a man. It's no longer that we are viewed merely as naive. Now the world views Christians as dangerous, morally dangerous. It is very common for Christians, certainly in Boston and much of New England, to be simply viewed as a bigot because of our dangerous views and beliefs. The world no longer sees us as the moral people. We are actually viewed as immoral people. We are blamed for all the problems in the world. And so it's very easy for the Christian community, for the church, to withdraw. God is calling the church today, and ever since God poured out his Spirit at Pentecost, to go into a world that doesn't know him, that doesn't know his kindness. And the question I want to propose is, I know this could be talking about mission could be, you know, theoretical, and not very practical. But the question I want to ask is, what are the places you do not want to go? Who are the people who scare you in terms of your identity as someone who believes in Jesus? What vocation scares you? What places scare you? Are we living our Christian lives only doing the things that are easy? Jonah wanted nothing with the very difficult word of going to the people of Nineveh. Part of the reality of following God in this world is we have to move into the places that scare us. We have to move towards the people who hate the God that we worship. One of the challenges of doing mission in this climate is that there's several. It's very difficult to reason with people on the basis of sin. The concept of sin is just very difficult to get across people nowadays. I would argue more often than that, that's probably not the best place to begin. Also, the world knows all our faults. They know all the faults of the church and Christianity. Some are true, some are a little bit, could be distorted, but the world knows all the faults of the church. And another reason it's difficult is, interestingly, the world we live in has, certainly the Western world, they have appropriated Christian goods. They have used Christian goods and Christian values without attribution. So it's very difficult to give Christianity the credit of a lot of the good that they've done. I think there are a lot of reasons for hope in, you know, us seeing the church as, you know, God's agent for missions. I've got these. I think, namely, it's the uniqueness of the Christian community, I think, is a very compelling apologetic to the truth of our faith. I think the Christian community that we find our identity not in where we come from, not in what we possess, but in our identity in the person of Jesus Christ. We find community across different social, ethnic, class lines in that. I think that is the greatest witness to the truth of Christianity today. You know, a lot of the other major religions, I used to teach comparative religions at a secular school in Florida before I did RUF, and it's interesting that 80% of Muslims still live in the Middle East and Southeast Asia. 80% of Buddhists live in East Asia. 90% of Hindus live in South Asia. 15 to 20% of Christians across global Christianity live in each of Asia, Latin America, Africa, Europe, and America. Christianity is the only world religion that is actually distributed across the continents. And I think the early church, I'll be preaching through the book of Acts this semester. I'm really looking forward to that. I think the early church, the community that you see there, the community that we have been called to be is a great apologetic for Christianity. And I think it's a great kind of way to do missions, is to be a hospitable people and place where people, where anyone can come, ask the difficult questions, and explore Christianity. It's very difficult work. Missions is very difficult. It's you know, especially in New England. I was talking with my pastor yesterday, who's been in Boston for 5 years planting a church. And he met his neighbor, and his neighbor, or he asked his neighbor, "How long you've been here in Boston?" And he says, "Not very long, 26 years." And he's actually being sincere. Like 26 years. If you're 40 some, and you've been in Boston 26 years, you actually don't think you're from the area. Someone told another pastor, it's going to take 10 years for you to get invited. It's for you to be sitting in the living room of your neighbor. And amazingly, 10 years after he moved to Boston, this is another pastor, he was sitting in the room, in the living room of his neighbor. It takes years to build those relationships. So I want to encourage you to consider the mission that God has called you, God has called your church. Embrace it. Don't flee from it. Pray for God's help. It is very difficult, but I do believe God has called us to that. So first is consider your mission. Second, consider your theology. Your theology. Well, Jonah's theology, it's been noted, is pretty good. Every statement he makes about God is true. It's orthodox. He's got impeccable theology. He passes his theology exam. And, you know, us Reformed people we have a reputation of having good theology, and it can make us certainly prideful. The problem is not whether our theology is indeed sound or not, but rather how we're determining our theological acumen. The Apostles' Creed, it doesn't say, "I know God the Father Almighty." It says, "I believe in God the Father Almighty. I believe in Jesus Christ, His only Son." Theology is not just knowing something. Jonah knows all the right theology. It's believing in the things that we proclaim about God. If we truly, whatever it is we truly believe, and everyone believes in something, sometimes it's inconsistent, but we all believe in something. Whatever it is we truly believe, our lives will reflect, our actions will reflect that belief. See, just as Jonah hates his mission, he actually hates his theology. Here he says of God, "You're a gracious God and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and relenting in disaster." This is the clearest declaration, revelation of God in the Old Testament. Whereas God is slow to anger and Jonah is angry. Whereas God is full of mercy, Jonah does not want to show mercy. This is actually a very impressive thing that Jonah does in using this revelation of God to file his complaint. The second commandment in Exodus chapter 20, God says, "Don't make images, don't worship them." And it's in Exodus 20. There's a rationale given for the second commandment, and it speaks of a jealous God who will visit the iniquity of the fathers of the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. So there is this negative rationale for keeping the second commandment. Do not make an image. there is this punitive language inserted there. Sometime later, God's people would make an image in the golden calf in Exodus 32. And the guy who led them, a guy named Moses, goes to God and tries to ask for mercy upon God's people. And what's interesting is Jonah knows this. Jonah knows this story. He knows his theology. Let me actually read from Exodus chapter 34. So this is after the golden calf incident. Moses is asking God to relent from disaster, and here's actually God speaking of himself. The Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquities of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and the fourth generation. Jonah's theological skill of drawing on this account is very impressive. When he complains, saying, this is the kind of God you are. You're a gracious God, merciful, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love, relenting of disaster. He leaves out the punitive language. Why does he do that? Well, it's pretty simple. It's that punitive part that he wishes God would use upon the Ninevites. God's grace is not so onerous to Jonah. He just simply hates it when God's grace is given to those people he does not like. Or in other words, he actually does not understand grace. Jonah does not think that these people deserve God's grace. It's actually bad theology. Jonah's problem is not that his theology is too astute. Rather, it's too flawed. He does not like the grace of God. The irony is that God's mercy to Israel is even more scandalous than his mercy to Nineveh. At least the Ninevites repented. Jonah is angry because he can't change God. But more on his anger in a moment. Jonah's deepest convictions and disposition is in striking contrast with what he verbally acknowledges is true about God. And I want to ask you, what is it that you believe about God? I think an honesty with our theology, which is part of thing that's going on here in this chapter with Jonah, I think for us to truly live out our faith in a way that pleases God, we need to be honest about our theology. And we can't just say, yeah, everything I say about God comes easy for me to believe. It is it is the nature of sin to not believe even the good things about God. And we need to be honest about that. There might be some things about God that trouble us, or perhaps we might even hate. There might be some things about God that we find difficult to accept. So consider our mission, our theology, and finally, our anger. Jonah says to God, kill me. And God responds, let's talk about your anger. God is very interested in Jonah's anger. What does the Bible say about anger? Well, Actually, a lot. If you read the Psalms, a lot of the Psalms are written out of anger. Christianity does not say it's okay to be depressed, it's okay to be upset, it's okay to be worried, but don't be angry. Angry is a real emotion that God never asks us to suppress or to deny. It's like our theology, something we need to be honest with. In fact, Paul writes in Ephesians, be angry and do not sin, which is hard to do. often when I'm angry, I am at the very, middle of sinning. We see the way the psalmists tell God about their anger. Let me ask, why is Jonah angry here? In verse 9, God asks him, Do you do well to be angry for the plant? And he says, yes, I do well to be angry, angry enough to die. And for the first time in this story, for the very first time in this story of Jonah, he answers God. And it is an outburst from the depth of his heart. He has never answered a question from God until he asks him, why are you angry? He is admitting his anger for the very first time. And he doesn't just observe his anger. He endorses it. He says, it is good and right that I am angry. And obviously there is a lot going on here. But behind his desire for death is his anger. And underneath his anger is his pity. Pity can be it can be a confusing term here. It's actually synonymous with compassion. When you pity something, you want something to receive mercy and not justice. I can say, well, I pity my golf game. I wish I got lucky and my score didn't reflect my horrible skills. When you pity something, you want that thing, when you pity a plant, you want that plant to survive even though everything in nature is saying this plant is going to die. Unlike Jonah's merciless hatred for Nineveh, his pity is an emotion God can work with. Because underneath pity, there is some measure of love. There's some tenderness toward the vulnerable. Pity is a desire that something should not die, but something that thing should live. And we need to ask ourselves what it is, what are the things that we pity? Anger is essentially a disordered love. And we see that we ought to order our love. When we consider mission, in order to do missions, we need to love a God of mercy and grace. We need to love God's unconditional love. Same thing with theology. Do we truly love a God who's slow to anger, full of mercy, abounding in steadfast love? The way to get to the heart of your unwillingness to do the mission of God, the way to get to the heart of the things about God you find offensive, is to get to the heart of your anger. Because God can deal with your anger, because underneath that anger there is some tenderness, some compassion, passion there, even here with Jonah. There is always some longing for good and a desperate cry for God to make that a reality. The point of this story, a very short story, can be read 15 minutes, as Jonah is not a good missionary. He's not a good prophet. He doesn't have good theology. In fact, all this leads to his disobedience and even his desire to die. There are so many things that we pity. We pity our resume. We pity our finances. We pity our children, our marriages. God pities New England and all its cattle. But not only does God pity people and cows, he pities Jonah. I think that's one of the shocking things about God's mercy and compassion in this story. Mercy and compassion that was shown to the sailors on those boats who represented the nations. His mercy and compassion upon the Ninevites. But his mercy to Jonah is a shocking thing. He pities Jonah so much that he sends a storm. He sends a fish. He sends him to the Ninevites. He sends the plant, the worm, the sun, the wind. He sends all these things for Jonah. And for all of us, for we all have something in common with Jonah. God sent his son, who testified to Jonah. You know, God, there is a righteous anger, and it is never shown in this story. God never shows his righteous anger until his son, the perfect one, the prophet who obeyed, went to the cross, so that you and I can receive God's grace and mercy, his patience, and his steadfast love to us. Let me pray for us.